This is Dr. Roger Green in his church history course, Reformation to the Present. This is session number 13, The Great Awakening.
In terms of where we are, this is the evangelical resurgence in the church. And in the last lecture, we saw some really real severe criticism of the church and of Christianity and of the Bible and of things that Christians hold dear and so forth. But that wasn't the last word, because the pendulum is now swinging in a new direction with what we call the evangelical resurgence in the church. Now, that resurgence did not take place in France, as we mentioned. France had become pretty thoroughly de-Christianized. But it did take place in Germany, in England, and in America. And those three kind of events, in a sense, were happening pretty much, not exactly, but pretty much simultaneously. So those three, there was Great Awakening in Western Europe, parts of Western Europe, and Great Awakening in America. So first we talked about Germany and the resurgence in Germany, and that's a movement called Pietism, and Spener Frank and Count Nicholas Ludwig von Zinzendorf. So we talked about that. So the Pietism. Now we're into America, and we're into the Great Awakenings in America. There were two or three of them, as we mentioned. There was 1734, there was 1800, and then there was, in the middle of the century, 1850 or so, there was another. Was there another awakening? Was there a third Great Awakening? Or was this a continuation of the second Great Awakening? We'll let the scholars kind of talk about that and worry about that. For our course, though, we're only concerned with the first Great Awakening. So we're focusing in mid-18th century what is happening. Okay, and just a reminder, we talked about Theodore J. Frelinghuysen. If any of you are from New Jersey, you would know this name, Frelinghuysen. He brought a resurgence to the Dutch Reformed Church. We talked about Gilbert Tennent and how important he was, especially as he learned from Frelinghuysen. But Tennent was Presbyterian, brought resurgence and evangelical awakening of Presbyterianism in New Jersey and middle colonies. We ended with George Whitefield and how important George Whitefield is, because he, first of all, he was British coming over, came over seven times, died here, as we mentioned, but he also crossed denominational lines. He was a revivalist in the truest sense, not just of the churches, but revivalists of people outside the churches, sinners repenting, coming in, believing in Christ, joining churches, and so forth. So he very magnetic kind of personality, preaching in the streets and preaching in the village squares and so forth. So he's the person who convinced John Wesley. We'll talk about Wesley later, but he's the person who convinced John Wesley to preach in the open air, not just limit his preaching to church buildings, but go out into the open air and preach. And Whitefield, of course, did that. So this kind of grand itinerant, we've called him, and he certainly was that. So that's the first three important leaders of the First Great Awakening, Frelinghuysen, Tennent, and Whitefield. Any questions about these three folks and their kind of bringing revivalism to American shores and bringing this resurgence? This, in a sense, is an answer to deism. As deism was starting to take hold and so forth, and this is the answer to deism. Okay, all right. Let's go on to the person you're going to associate the First Great Awakening with most clearly, and that is Jonathan Edwards. Okay, Jonathan Edwards, pretty remarkable. In fact, the date we gave of the First Great Awakening, 1734, comes from the awakening in Jonathan Edwards' church. Jonathan Edwards was at a church in Northampton, Massachusetts, kind of mid-state, I guess. He was at Northampton, Massachusetts, in a congregational church there. And Jonathan Edwards, because of his preaching and his biblical preaching, there was a great revival that broke out in his church and neighboring churches. And so 1734, the date given for the First Great Awakening, is because of what happened in Jonathan and in his church, but also because Jonathan Edwards became such an important leader in the First Great Awakening. and was recognized as one of the great preachers, writers, and so forth of the First Great Awakening. What Jonathan Edwards did, as well as these other people, but it was most evident in Jonathan Edwards, is that, and we're going to see this later as well, but we'll mention it here, Jonathan Edwards brought Calvinism back into the American consciousness. Because remember, Calvinism came over here with the Pilgrims, but especially the Puritans in the Massachusetts Bay Colony. These people were Calvinists, remember? And so the Puritans were Calvinists, and then you had other groups that were Calvinists, like some of the Baptists in Rhode Island. But by 1734, Calvinism had kind of died out in American public life and religious life. And Jonathan Edwards was a good Calvinist. So in his preaching and in his teaching, he brought Calvinism back into the mainstream as the kind of the theological life of America here. So his revivals were very kind of Calvinistic in terms of his preaching. God couldn't have chosen a person more distinctly different from Whitfield in his preaching style. Whitfield was the great, very rambunctious, great enthusiastic, we showed you pictures of Whitfield preaching. Whitfield was very much charismatic, outgoing. Jonathan Edwards was the exact opposite. Jonathan Edwards was a very quiet preacher. It was said of Jonathan Edwards that when he preached, he kept his eyes focused on the rope of the church bell in the back of the church, and that's what he looked at while he preached from the scriptures. So very what might be considered dry preaching, but very biblical preaching, and people were convicted by that biblical preaching. So here's God, you know, choosing two different kinds of persons. And I remember when I was in seminary, the definition we were given for preaching was, preaching is God's truth coming through personality. And so that was certainly true of Whitfield and Jonathan Edwards, two different kinds of persons, no doubt. So very, very important. And, of course, you know what Jonathan Edwards looks like, but there's a picture of Jonathan Edwards and his preaching. That's all we'll say about Jonathan Edwards. He led a fascinating life. I like to tell my students that he studied about 16 hours a day, even though he had a wife and large family, but he studied about 16 hours a day. That's good. Isn't that a good example? So, and that 16 hours a day of studying and the great preaching, that's what brought the revival, because the Bible spoke for itself in a sense. So I think that's a good thing, to study so much in your life. And you will accomplish a great deal in life by your study, if you're faithful to your study. So we'll let Jonathan give us that old message for the day. So Jonathan, are there any questions about Jonathan before we leave him? We're going to come to reactions to the First Great Awakening and then the results of the First Great Awakening. But any questions about Jonathan? I mean, we're not spending too long with his biography, or the biography of any of these people. We are going to spend a little bit longer time with the biography of John Wesley. But. All right, let's look at the reaction to the First Great Awakening in America. There were basically three reactions, and we want to kind of mention those three. So, first of all, some denominations were divided over the First Great Awakening. So I'm on page 13 and right down there, C3 there, reaction to the First Great Awakening. Some denominations were very divided over the First Great Awakening. And one example of that were the Presbyterians. Now, when we say Presbyterians in the middle of the 18th century, that's not quite as clear as Presbyterian denominations today, because Presbyterians and Congregationalists, very close kind of, it was hard to tell Presbyterians from Congregationalists at times. We mentioned Charles Grandison Finney. He was first ordained as a Presbyterian minister, then became a Congregational minister, but that wasn't hard to do in those days. But basically, among the Presbyterians, there was a division within the denomination. Now, it didn't cause different denominations to form, but there was definitely two different opinions. There was what was called the Old Side Party of the Presbyterians. And the Old Side Party of the Presbyterians did not like revivalism. this revivalism was too emotional, too charismatic. They didn't see it as biblical and so forth. So the old side party among the Presbyterians really kind of spoke against the revivals that were going on. And of course, they would have been aware of the pietism. They would have been aware of the Wesleyan revival in England and so forth. And they didn't like this. They were very opposed to this. The new side party, on the other hand, the new side party were pro-revival, pro-awakening. They thought that what is happening here is of God, and it is kind of like the New Testament church. So in one church, you could have old side party people and new side party people in one church. They didn't form different denominations, but they definitely had difference of opinion about what was going on with this revival and what they heard about revivals in other places. So that's the first kind of reaction. There was division, kind of division in the ranks in a sense. A second reaction came from some pretty important people, and one of the most important was a fellow by the name of Charles Chauncey. Now, there's another name I just kind of like to pronounce because it's kind of a nice name to have. Charles Chauncey. It sounds pretty high class, doesn't it? Charles Chauncey. Well, as a matter of fact, Charles Chauncey was a pretty high class guy. Charles Chauncey was the pastor of the First Congregational Church in Boston. So you couldn't have a more kind of prestigious pastor and a more prestigious church and a more influential church than the First Congregational Church in Boston. And he was the pastor. And he disliked the revival that was going on, and he spoke against the revival. And so because he was a person of influence, of power, influence, had a powerful church, he's going to have a pretty big influence in some people turning against the revival, but he's very influential in this at this time. Charles Chauncey has an interesting life. He's a congregational now during this First Great Awakening. He's a congregational preacher, and to show you how kind of liberal he was, he eventually became Unitarian before he died. So he kind of moved into that deism, Unitarianism, and that's why he spoke against the revival. So he wanted, he didn't want all this emotionalism. He wanted sobriety. He wanted everything to be tested by reason. He sounds like an enlightened person, doesn't he? Well, he was. So sobriety and reason and rationality when it comes to religious life, that's what we want, and the revival is doing something completely different. So Charles Chauncey, very important reaction, okay? Third reaction is that there was opposition from some universities. Some universities, university presidents and presidents and faculty and students were in opposition to the revival. So I'm going to mention two, just by way of illustration here. I'm going to, first of all, Yale University. Now, Yale had been founded by a Puritan, and like Harvard had been, Yale had been founded by a Puritan. And so it's ironic that now in the middle of the 18th century, Yale is very kind of almost anti-religious. So the professors and the students and people at Yale don't like what's going on here. Okay, now, long story short on Yale, however, that's ironic. It's not only ironic because Yale was begun by Puritans to teach the Bible and to teach preachers how to preach and so forth and congregationalists, but it's ironic because in 1800, so, you know, we're at 1734, we're in the middle of the 18th century, in 1800, the Second Great Awakening began at Yale. So here in the middle of the 18th century, you get this anti-revivalistic thing. But 50 years later, you get the Second Great Awakening starting there, which I think is really ironic and really a wonderful kind of conclusion to Yale's opposition to this awakening. The second opposition was Harvard. Second example of the opposition was Harvard. All right, now, Harvard has an interesting story because Harvard was begun by John Harvard, a good Puritan, 1636. He gave his library of 400 books to begin this university, and he Harvard was founded, of course, to train preachers, basically. And now 150 years later, or not quite, 120 years later, whatever, Harvard is pretty much Unitarian. It's deistic. It's Unitarian. It did not hold to its first love, and it becomes pretty critical of the First Great Awakening. Now, an example of this, and I'm not sure exactly when this happened. I need to research this a little more. But I'm always fascinated by, what is Harvard's motto? What is Harvard's motto? You see it all over the place. You see it on T-shirts. And what's Harvard's motto? Anybody? Pretty interesting motto. Veritas. Veritas. You would see, when you see Harvard emblems, you see Veritas, which means truth. That's the motto of Harvard University. But it's interesting that the original motto, that when it was founded in 1636 by John Harvard, the original motto was Veritas in Christo et Ecclesiam, truth in Christ and in the church. So it's interesting that 100 years later or so, they dropped in Christ and in the church. I don't know the exact date that they did that, so I need to check that out. But it's interesting, Harvard dropped that second half of the motto, in Christ and in the church. Let that go. Now it's just truth, you know? So that's kind of interesting. But anyways, Harvard, the professors, faculty, students spoke out against the revival. Too much emotionalism. Everything should be measured by reason. And this thing that's happening is kind of unreasonable. So there were definitely three reactions to the Great Awakening and three ways in which the Great Awakening might have kind of caved in, but it didn't. So we'll talk about the lasting results of the Great Awakening, the First Great Awakening, theological, social. But before we do, are there any questions about those reactions to the First Great Awakening? Anything about that? Should we go on here? Okay, bless your hearts. We'll go on here. Results of the First Great Awakening. I've divided them into two sections, theological and social. But having said that, where does one end and the other begin? I can't say that I know that. I'm just going to look at these two sections, and you'll see that sometimes there's overlap with these. So let's talk about the theological first. Theological results of the First Great Awakenings. Okay. Number one, the first thing is something we've already talked about. There was certainly a resurgence of Calvinism in the First Great Awakening. Brought here by the Puritans, it died down, and then there's a resurgence of Calvinistic theology. All four of those people we mentioned, Frelinghuysen and Tennent and Whitfield and Jonathan Edwards, were all Calvinists. So there's a real resurgence of Calvinism, and it's taking center stage again. Now, it's not going to last because the pendulum's going to swing again. But right now, that's theologically, that becomes very, very important. So one of the central messages of all of these people was the message of election. God elects certain sinners to be saved. God predestined certain sinners to be saved. So you see that and so you've got this whole resurgence of Calvinism. So a second thing that you get is what I call a revival of experiential piety. And by experiential piety, what I mean is placing a high priority on loving God and loving your neighbor. Not just knowing God and knowing all the doctrines about God. That's all right to do that, but experiential piety is a real love, a real commitment to God, and a real love and commitment to your neighbor as well. It's kind of the Matthew 22, love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, soul, love your neighbor as yourself. So there was a renewal, a revival of that experiential piety. Now, it was this experiential piety that the people like Charles Chauncey preached against. But nevertheless, it took hold and was very important for many people. So, okay, number three kind of result. This was a major test for religious life now was personal conversion. Was there a time in your life, or is there a time now in your life, that you said yes to Christ? This emphasis upon personal conversion. So that becomes a real kind of major test here. So it's not theological creed. Can you recite the creed? It's not what church you belong to. It's not how often you go to church. It's not living a good moral life. All those things are important. But the major test now is personal conversion. And so the awakening really emphasized that personal conversion. Okay? And number four, notice I put this under theological, but you could put it also under social as well. But the First Great Awakening stimulated a concern for higher education. Now, these examples of higher education are mainly preparation for the ministry. That's why they were founded. But Princeton, we mentioned the founding of Princeton before, Gilbert Tennant, the Log College, Princeton. But Princeton was founded to train Presbyterian ministers. So that Rhode Island College, now you probably, there is a Rhode Island College today, but it's not the same one, because the one that was founded by the Baptists, first called Rhode Island College, I think it was founded in Warren, Rhode Island, as I recall. But that became Brown University, 1764. Queen's College, interesting, the original title, now called Rutgers University. I have an interest in Rutgers because I've got a couple of nieces who've gone through Rutgers, a couple of nephews. I got a nephew in Rutgers right now, or a grandnephew in Rutgers right now. But that was founded by the Dutch Reformed Church to teach Dutch Reformed ministers. And then Dartmouth College, I'm giving this 1769. There had been a missionary school to the Native Americans, to the Indians, previous to this, that evolved into Dartmouth. But usually, I think Dartmouth gives this as the founding of their institution, as a congregational institution, trained congregational preachers. So the question is, here we have, is this theological or is it social? Well, it's obviously both. If you're beginning, you know, social institutions like this, but it's also theological because this is founded to train preachers in all these various Christian denominations to get the message of the gospel out. Now, I would say, knowing these places today, I think that a lot of people on these campuses probably don't realize this or probably have forgotten it. The Presbyterians, certainly the Baptists, certain Dutch Reformed Congregationalists. I'm just curious, have any of you been to Princeton? Have any of you seen Princeton? Okay, what about Brown in Providence? We need to take a field trip. What about Rutgers? No Rutgers people. What about Dartmouth? Not too far from us. Okay, one for Dartmouth. All right. Well, these are very beautiful institutions, very interesting places. But remember the reason that they were founded. And that's very important in terms of theological contributions. Okay, are there any questions about these theological kind of results of the First Awakening? Very, very important, no doubt about that. Okay, let's come to social. And we said the social and theological sometimes overlap. But there is no question that the social contributions of the First Great Awakening to society were tremendous. And we'll see how great they were. As I've got a final quotation that I give here. So see how remarkable they were. Okay, number one, there is certainly the elevation of the common person with the First Great Awakening. Okay, and there's the elevation of the common person because the most essential thing in your life is a religious experience, an experience with Christ. That is available to everybody. So there is no kind of hierarchy in terms of how God works. God works with everybody, and so the man on the street, as it were, I doubt if they use that term in those days, but the man on the street or the woman on the street, that those people knew that they were just as important as the trained clergy and people in political office and so forth. So there's definitely the elevation of the common person. Now, socially, That's going to be very important on American soil, that the common person, with the democratization of American public life, the common person is going to be have real power, no doubt about that. So that is going to be, that's going to be pretty critical. So, okay. Number two, with the First Great Awakening, there's a stress on lay activity. Not just the ordained preachers, not just the ordained ministers. I'm going to go back and do that again. Why did I? I love that. I wonder why I did that. Isn't that cool? Why did I do that? I don't know, but I kind of like what I see here. So anyways, keep your attention. That's the most important thing. Okay, so lay activity is stressed, which means what? Which means new roles of leadership. So up until this time, who was the leader in the community? The leader in the community was basically the minister or the priest. Well, there weren't many Roman Catholics in America at the time, but the minister was the leader in the community. Now lay people can take leadership roles, but they can take leadership roles not only in the church, but now they realize that they can take leadership roles outside of the church in the broader society. That is going to have an impact on American public life. But it all started in the church. That's the important thing with the Great Awakening. So, number three, personal independence in religious life. So, you know, it's Jesus and me. I came to Christ. I made this decision for Christ. Well, that personal independence in religious life pointed to independence in political life. So just as I made a personal decision in my religious life, now I'm going to be called to make a personal decision in my political life or my social life in the broader society. So that's going to be pretty important. You know, I mean, obviously, we're leading up to the American Revolution here. So so that's number three. Okay, number four is, with this Great Awakening, is a separation of church and state. Now remember, we've talked about the separation of church and state before, and the reason for the separation of church and state is so that the state won't kind of infringe and overpower itself on the church. It's ironic that the discussions of separation of church and state today are just the opposite. People are afraid that religion is going to have an influence on public life. Well, that's not the reason why people had the separation of church and state. They have the separation of church and state because they want to feel free and independent as denominations, as Christian churches, from any kind of state control. So there is definitely a separation of church and state. So that's another kind of social thing. Number five is a new humanitarian impulse, because what does the gospel, as all these people are preaching, what are they saying? Love God, love your neighbor. A new humanitarian impulse, a caring for the poor, a caring for the widows, a caring for the orphans. Whose job is it to do that? That is the job of the church, to do that. That's where you first learn to do that, by hearing the preacher preach and then by very practical means. Good example was George Whitefield helped to found an orphanage in Georgia that was needed, and he helps to found it. That's part of the gospel, loving God, loving your neighbor. So, now, what happens is this humanitarian impulse comes over into American public life. So, and people, there's a humanitarian impulse that comes into American public life even with people who aren't particularly religious, but there's still that humanitarian impulse. So, and we, if you fast forward, we see that today. The American public, the American people are the most generous people in the world in terms of humanitarian charitable work. Did you read about the story by any chance? This has nothing to do with anything, so yikes. Okay, but anyways, did you read about the story about the homeless man who found some money on the streets of Boston? And it was quite a bit of money and like traveler's checks and stuff. And he found the family and gave it back, you know, as an act of, you know, a Christian act, really, I think, in his own life. But he was homeless. He had nothing himself, but he gave all that money back that he found, you know. And someone saw that. Someone read about that or saw it on television and decided they were going to raise money for this guy because he did such a humanitarian, wonderful thing. And the last count, they had raised $200,000 for him. So from the American public, you know. So that the American public, very, very wonderful people giving out of their hearts. Now it started in the church, but it comes into American public life, and people are very generous. Not necessarily, some are very generous for religious reasons, obviously, but many people are generous. They're not religious people, but it became part of American public life. So the humanitarian impulse. New forms of assembly comes in the as a result of the First Great Awakening. So, new forms of assembly. All right. Now, these new forms of assembly took different. There were different aspects to this new form of assembly, but in this new form of assembly, it meant that people could assemble themselves in public places. Now, they haven't been doing this. They haven't been assembling themselves in public places. But with the First Great Awakening, they learned to do this, especially with George Whitefield. Because where did Whitefield preach? He preached on Boston Common, and he preached in parks, and he preached in on town squares and so forth. So you got this new kind of idea of assembling in public, now for a religious reason, to hear the gospel preached. But this new form of assembly, and this new form of assembly also was strictly voluntary. Nobody had to come. Nobody was making you go to church, or nobody was making you go to hear George Whitefield preach, or no one was making you, you know, you couldn't vote in Massachusetts unless you went to hear George Whitefield preach. Nobody's saying that. So this is voluntary kind of assembly. So, and then what happened with these new forms of assembly is that I meant to mention also, with this new form of assembly is new authority. Because the leader in this new form of assembly has an authority not based on, it wasn't given to him by the state. It wasn't handed down to him by the state like a king or a magistrate or a prince or something. This new authority in this new form of assembly was a recognition that this person is of God and that this person is preaching the word of God. So a recognition that the authority is not handed down, but the authority comes from another, from a godly source. So with this new form of assembly, people coming together, not being coerced to come together, not being forced to come together, hearing this leadership, this wonderful kind of charismatic leadership. What that does, these new forms of assembly, which began religiously, they transfer into what? Into the political sphere. And so people start to realize, boy, we can do this politically too. We can assemble in public voluntarily. No one's making us do it. We can assemble in public, we can assemble voluntarily, we can hear leaders, they're not just told that they are leaders, but we can hear leaders, we see an authority in those leaders. They might not have a public office, but they have authority in what they say and so forth. And this can easily transfer, politically and socially, which it did. So the new forms of assembly incredible. The next one is the sovereignty of the people. Critical of public office. So the sovereignty of the people, which was released in a sense, the independence of the people was released in this whole First Great Awakening. But the sovereignty of the people, critical of public office. So now people feel in these new forms of assembly quite free to criticize public office. They feel free to criticize England, in our case, you know, and the king, in our case. So they feel quite free. Now what gives them that freedom is the sheer weight of numbers in this public assembly kind of stuff. So the sheer weight of numbers gives them that freedom to do that. And Boston, you know, you walk the streets in Boston, you walk the Freedom Trail, and you see some of that. Okay. Now, what's the bottom line of all of this? So here's the quotation I'd like you to get. But I'll try to remember to put these PowerPoints on Blackboard, by the way. So if you don't get everything down, that's fine. But I love this quotation. Considered as a social event, the Great Awakening signifies nothing less than the first stage of the American Revolution. Considered as a social event, the Great Awakening signifies nothing less than the first stage of the American Revolution. So you have to ask yourself, would the American Revolution have happened if there hadn't been a first Great Awakening? I think the answer to that probably is no. I think the first Great Awakening and everything we've talked about in terms of both theological and social kind of outpouring of the first Great Awakening, I think the answer is no, because I think what happened in the first Great Awakening, especially socially here, was it gave the groundwork, the foundation for a political revolution. And then people picked up on that, and off they ran with the political revolution. So that's very interesting that there is a connection between the religious life in America and the revolution that came with the American Revolution. So, okay, yeah. Oh. Yes, the Great Awakening did reach. Now, there were some places, that were still kind of being, in a sense, settled out in Tennessee, Kentucky. But it reached from Maine to Georgia, all the middle colonies. Everybody was affected by the Great Awakening, first Great Awakening. Yeah, and also, it wasn't a frontier awakening. It was an urban awakening. So it was in places like Boston and Philadelphia and New York and places like that where it came to life. So yes, it is pretty powerful. Okay, something else about the first Great Awakening. What do we want to know about the first Great Awakening? All those wonderful people and all those wonderful events happening in first Great Awakening. Anything here? Should I give you 5 seconds? I should. 5 second break here. Before the first Great Awakening. I mean, before the Wesleyan Revival, I should say. Just take a quick break here. You can do this Friday, Monday, and Wednesday, then you're halfway through the course, halfway through the semester. Yikes. Okay. Stretch, rest. Ruth is the only one who has a class before this, right? None of you have class before this except Ruth. So it's kind of out of bed and into this class. Right, okay. All right, well, we are going to journey on here. And there's another thing happening. And it's happening in England, and it's called the Wesleyan Revival. Okay, so I'm on D, England, and the Wesleyan Revival. So that's happening along with Pietism and the that's happening in Germany, along with the First Great Awakening. That's happening in America, and now in England, you have the Wesleyan Revival. Okay, now I need to be careful here because if you come into my office, the first thing you see is a bust of John Wesley. So come and visit me someday. I'll show you a bust of John Wesley. I'll show you a few pictures of John Wesley in my office too. So I need to be careful here. I could spend a long time on this, like probably a whole semester. So I'm going to try not to do that. I'm going to try to put all this in perspective and kind of deal with this, good balance and everything. But that Wesleyan Revival is pretty important. And it's kind of easy to ignore that Wesleyan Revival. But for this course, we're going from the Reformation to the present. You can't bypass the Wesleyan Revival. Okay, so what we're going to do is an introduction. And then we're going to give a biographical sketch of John Wesley. And then some theology of John Wesley that you're going to see is both similar and different. Similar to, different from the theology of the First Great Awakening. So it's kind of a balance to what we see in the First Great Awakening. So, okay. Okay. First of all, introduction. In order to introduce John Wesley, let me skip that picture, I need to come to a man by the name of Jacob Arminius. So there is Jacob Arminius. Okay, Jacob Arminius, long story short on Jacob Arminius. Jacob Arminius was a Dutchman. He was in the Netherlands. And Jacob Arminius was asked by the Dutch Calvinists of his day, he was asked to provide a defense of Calvinism. So he was a theologian, and he was asked to provide a defense of Calvinism. And when Arminius was asked to do that, I mean, he took it on willingly, and when he was asked to do that, however, he found that there were some places where he disagreed with Calvinism. There were some places where he didn't think John Calvin or his followers were right. And so he began to discuss those things. And actually, he wrote something called the Remonstrance. I should have put that last. But he and his followers developed what they called a Remonstrance. That's not the first word, it's the second word. Remonstrance. They developed a Remonstrance, which was kind of a detailed argument against Calvinism. Not, I shouldn't say that. It's not a detailed argument against Calvinism. It's a detailed argument about Calvinism, because there were some things in Calvinism that they liked and that they held on to. So they are not kind of anti-Calvinists, these Dutch folks. Okay, what happened was they kind of formed a group, and the group was called the Remonstrants, first word, Remonstrants, the Remonstrants. So the Remonstrants formed the Remonstrants. Okay, you okay with that? And the Remonstrants was an argument about Calvinism. So let me just give you a couple of examples, because if you don't understand these examples, you're not going to understand everything else we say. So let me give you a couple of examples. One example was, and we'll stay just with Arminius here, but one example was Arminius disagreed with Calvin's doctrine of double election. So he reads John Calvin, he's supposed to defend Calvin, but he says, I cannot defend Calvin on the issue of double election. I do believe in predestination, Arminius said. I believe in predestination, but I connect predestination to God's foreknowledge. So God foreknows those who are going to be saved. And he foreknows people who are going to use the means of grace to come into God's family. He foreknows that. So if you want to call that predestination, Arminius said, that's fine. I'm glad to do that. But I don't believe it as Calvin taught it. So that's one example. So a second example is while Calvin taught that Christ died for the elect, Arminius said, no, Christ died for everybody. Christ died for the whosoever. Now, it happens to be it's only those who embrace the death of Christ who will benefit from his death. But Christ died for everybody. Christ's death was for the whosoever. So he disagreed there a bit and tried to explain that. So, okay. And a third thing that Arminius said, I am at one with Calvin. I believe, I'm so glad what Calvin said, in that there's nothing that we can do to save ourselves. There's no good in us by which we can save ourselves. Remember the Roman Catholic facere quod in se est, do what you're able to do, as though there's some good within human beings by which they're able to come to God? Well, Arminius agreed with Calvin. There's no good in us by which we're able to come to God. It's all by God's grace. This whole business of salvation is all by God's grace. So here he agreed with Calvin. He said, I'm at one with Calvin on this one, so that's a good thing. So, all right, and a fourth thing that he got discussing here, Calvin believed that the grace of God was irresistible. You cannot resist the grace of God. Arminius said, no, I don't believe that, because there is a residue of free will in people, so people can resist the grace of God. They can reject the grace of God. So that's a possibility. It's not a likelihood, Arminius believe, but it is a possibility that they can say no to God's grace. So, and then fifthly, when it came to the doctrine of perseverance, God perseveres in holding on to us. Remember we talked about perseverance with John Calvin? Perseverance with Calvin is not, we're not reaching up to God and just barely holding on to God with our fingertips, you know. Calvin's understanding of perseverance is this is God's perseverance of holding on to us. This is God having us in his arms and holding on to us. Well, when it came to the doctrine of perseverance, Arminius wasn't certain about this, but he did believe that it's possible to lose that salvation, for possible for one to lose that salvation once one had gained it. So there were various places in which Arminius disagreed with Calvin, his followers, the Remonstrants, really developed this theology. Now, the reason we mention this by way of introduction is because this is the theology that John Wesley would have been trained in. He would have understood this theology. He would have understood Calvin, of course, because he read Calvin, but he would have understood Arminian theology, because Arminian theology had become part of British life by the time you get to the 18th century. So John Wesley would have been very familiar with this. Question is, was John Wesley fully an Arminian? I'm not sure about that. I prefer to talk about Wesley's theology as Wesleyan theology and not Wesleyan Arminian theology. So I'm not sure about that. But we're going to talk about Wesleyan theology, but he certainly knew Arminius, and there were certainly places where he agreed with Arminius. So I give that introduction just so that we'll know where we're kind of starting here with all of this. So are there any questions about Arminius? So that's another kind of need-to-know name for this course, because he's a major player in the course, and from the Reformation to the present. So his kind of coming into this is important. So, okay, any questions there about that? Okay. Yeah.
So
yeah,
Jesse.
Right. He knew Calvin well, had read Calvin's successors. He also is a biblical scholar, so he's trying to put these things together. His first allegiance is to the Bible, so he feels he's answering biblically some things he disagrees with, like double election. So, and his followers forming this party, this group, the Remonstrants, felt the same way. Yeah. But Calvin also feels he's substantiating everything by Scripture, so you get, yeah. Something else, Arminius, Jacob Arminius, or this introduction, anything? Okay, let's just get started with Wesley, and then we'll have to pick this up on Friday. You see number two, I'm going to give a biographical sketch of John Wesley. So I do that with, about five people in the course? We certainly did that a bit with John Calvin, even though you read that book on Calvin. So I do this with John Wesley. I take some time to talk about his biography. I've got to watch it here, there again, because he was an interesting person, and if I've got a bust of John Wesley in my office, that must mean something. So I've got to be careful here. But I do want to give a bit of a biography of Wesley. So, okay, I've got his dates here for you. There are his dates of John Wesley. So, what I'd like to do is give some kind of high points here. John Wesley, 1703 to 1791. Okay, his father was Samuel, his mother was Susanna Wesley. And there she is, there are the dates of Susanna Wesley. Samuel Wesley was a priest, an Anglican priest. He had two churches. And I didn't do this PowerPoint very well, but I know you'll bear with me for just 1 minute, will you? Okay, these are the two churches of Samuel Wesley, two Anglican churches. The most important one was Epworth, and he also had a neighboring church called Root, that is pronounced Root, W-R-O-O-T-E. So here's his father, Anglican priest, and with these two parishes. And John Wesley is eventually going to follow in his father's footsteps and become ordained as an Anglican priest. So those places are important. Let's go back to the names here. His mother, Susanna. Now, Susanna was one of the great women in religious history. I think one of the options we gave for paper, I think, was women in Christian history or something like that. I have to check on that. But Susanna was definitely one of the great women in Christian history. She bore 19 children. That's a lot. That's a lot of children. She bore 19 children. 10 of them lived through their infancy and to become adults, and we'll be mentioning a couple of them. But whenever I talk about Susanna bearing 19 children, she was one of 25 children. Her mother bore 25 children. Can you even imagine that? I mean, but 25 children she bore. So Susanna was one of 25. So she only bore 19. So, you know, she didn't quite hit the record that her mother did. But pretty remarkable. But more than bearing 19 children, Susanna is known in religious history for being the kind of biblical and theological teacher of her children. She was very disciplined in teaching her children and in rearing her children up with biblical and theological knowledge. And especially that, of course, was true with John. And so Susanna is kind of very important to the story because of her influence upon John's spiritual growth, but also upon his academic growth as well. So Susanna was able to, she was a great tutor and very knowledgeable, was able to tutor him not only in Bible and theology, but in mathematics, in social history and history and so forth. So really a pretty remarkable person. When I think of Susanna, I think of someone else that we've already studied in the course, and her name was Anne Hutchinson. Do you remember Anne Hutchinson? Anne Hutchinson was the one who taught in Boston and taught theology in her home and discussed theology in her home, and the Puritans chased her out. She ended up down in Rhode Island. But these women were pretty remarkable with some real theological insights here. So, okay, so that's the beginning of his life. And he was actually born in the Epworth Rectory. By the way, I've got to be careful, I know, but I will be careful. But the Epworth Rectory burned down when John was just a little boy. And he was in the house when it burned down. And his father was able to save him, however. So his father and some other men ran in and got John out and saved John's life in the Epworth Rectory, and from the Epworth Rectory. And from then on, or when he got into his adult life, John Wesley referred to himself as a brand plucked from the fire. So a good biblical reference there. So there was John, and born in Epworth and almost died in Epworth in the rectory, but he was saved. So a friend of mine, this has nothing to do with anything either, but I got to watch my time. Okay, but a friend of mine and I were going to lead a tour of Wesleyan sites through England in 2015. And one of the places we'll be is the Epworth Rectory, because the Epworth Rectory was rebuilt and is now a historical site in England. So we're going to go to that Epworth Rectory. We're not going to light a match to it. You know, we're not going to redo the whole fire scene. But we're going to be in that Epworth Rectory, so I can't wait to be there. So, okay, so that's his born, that's his beginning and so forth, 1703. So, okay, now, what happens, another thing in terms of his biography, 1720 becomes a very important date in his life. 1720. Oh, I didn't put Samuel Wesley's name down here, too. I'll put Samuel Wesley's name down, his father. 1720 becomes a very important date in his life, and please notice he's only 17 years old, so he's not very old. In 1720, John Wesley enters Oxford University. So he goes and he becomes a student at Oxford University and you know there's many colleges at Oxford University, and he went to the college called Christ Church. So that was his place of learning at Oxford to begin his kind of undergraduate studies. So now, long story short is that he thought, John Wesley thought that God had called him to the ministry. So he goes to Christ Church. He is ordained to the Christian ministry, first as a deacon, And John Wesley feels he's going to spend the rest of his life as an Anglican priest, but he's going to be teaching. So long story short, he received a teaching opportunity at Lincoln College, which is another college of Oxford University. And once he settles down, once he begins teaching at Lincoln College, he settles down and he says to himself, this is where I'm going to be for the rest of my life. I'm going to be teaching Greek at Lincoln College. I'm happy. But long story short, before we go, just to take note, he wasn't at Lincoln College very long before his father, Samuel, took ill, and John had to leave his teaching, and he had to go back to Epworth and Root, and he had to kind of take over the ministry for his father because his father was so ill. So this was a bit of an interruption in his life, no doubt about that. And he didn't intend to be doing this, but he felt bound to do this to help his father. And he actually left for a couple of years. He left the college. Now, what happens is there are people back at the college, and they are studying also at Christ Church, and one of them was his brother Charles. So Charles Wesley, his younger brother, as you can see, there's an age difference of, 4 years between them. His younger brother Charles had entered Christ Church, had entered Oxford, and he was studying at Oxford during most of the time that that John was away at Epworth and Root. And something very, very interesting was happening with Charles Wesley and others at Oxford while John was away. So, and that's where we'll pick up the story on, we'll pick up that story on Friday. Okay, he was away at Epworth and Root, helping his father with that ministry. Charles at Oxford, something very interesting is happening. So we'll see what's happening when we come back on Friday. So have a good day. I'll see you Friday.
What was the name of that college?
This is Dr. Roger Green in his church history course, Reformation to the Present. This is session number 13, The Great Awakening.